This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. How many Jewish pigeon racers do you know who also played on the Duke men's basketball team and became the world's largest manufacturer of Christmas ornaments? Well, there can be only one, of course, and he would be Marshall Rausch. In addition to the aforementioned accomplishments, Marshall also had a career in politics. As a member of Gastonia's city council in the 1960s, he helped integrate local businesses. And there is much, much more, as you will see when we meet Marshall Rausch right here on The State of Things. Marshall Rausch, welcome to The State of Things. Good to have you on our program.
Thanks very much.
I want to talk about all of this, the Christmas ornaments and your political career. But take us back. You grew up on Long Island back in the days when Long Island was the country, right?
Oh, yes. It's nothing like it is now. Grew up in a little town comparable to maybe Belmont or Mount Holly in North Carolina. At this time, it was a great place to grow up. We were 1 mile from the Atlantic Ocean, and lots of youngsters, lots of open fields to play pickup football or baseball on. A lot of friends. Long Island.
You were born in 1923.
Right.
So tell us about growing up and what kind of activities you did. I understand a lot of museums and theater. Your mother, in particular, was very interested in seeing that you had that kind of cultural education.
Yeah, I certainly was fortunate because my mother would take me into New York on the weekends, and we went to the Museum of Natural History. I remember that was my favorite because the knights in armor had a big display there and the Indians. And we went to theater, and it was an opportunity living there that other kids might not have had. Even the baseball games. You know, talk to my friends in Gastonia now. They have to go 200 miles to see a National League baseball game. Oh, heck, we were right there with the Brooklyn Dodgers, the New York Yankees, and the Giants. And Madison Square Garden was also not too far away. So tremendous advantages, yet lived in the country with a whole lot of young people around.
You also raced pigeons. Now, some of what you talked about, baseball, museums, that stuff, beaches, I'm familiar with all of that. Pigeon racing, we didn't do that in Buffalo, New York. Tell us about raising pigeons.
Well, that was a great hobby. I remember several of my friends were into that also. I didn't get into that until I was about 12 years old. I think that's just about the right time. And I was just attracted to it right away. The purpose was to raise the pigeons and then race them. By racing them, we had a club. And they would take the pigeons on the train, I remember, maybe 100, 200 miles away, turn them loose, and then the idea was to have the first pigeon to get back to your coop.
So these had to be homing pigeons then, right?
Right. I think a real interesting thing is it could have been an expensive hobby, but what we did was we would catch we'd go out in the park with a wooden box, a stick, and a string. You put corn under the wooden box, and you put keep it raised with a short stick, and you got a string on the short stick, and you get far away. When the pigeons would go in there to eat the corn, pull the stick out, and you'd capture yourself some adult pigeons. And then we were able to buy eggs from a fellow who had some really good pigeons. I mean, I believe we paid like 35 cents for a pigeon egg, brought it home, and when the pigeons, by the way, the kind of stuff we got out of the park were called rats.
I don't think anybody would arrest you for stealing them. In fact, it would be considered public service, I guess.
That's right. And anyway, when they made it and had eggs, you could put other eggs in there with them, and they raised them.
Wow.
And eventually, you'd get a nice flock of really good pigeons. and had a lot of fun with it. I can remember one story worth telling. When I just got into it, I wanted to build a little pigeon coop. You might relate to it as like a big dog house and then a fly pen outside made out of chicken wire so that you could keep them in when you wanted. It was pretty big, like the whole thing might have been 10 foot by 4 foot. But anyway, I went looking for some lumber to build that coop. Didn't find any. I went down a cellar in my folks' house and found some nice boards, and I cut them up and made the pigeon coop. But my mother found out that I had taken those boards out of the cellar, and they were really extension pieces for the dining room table. That did not go, over well with anyone in the family.
No, because you can't really ever put those back, can you? They've been with the pigeons. So tell me a little bit more. It's a great story. And you played basketball too in high school, right?
Yeah, I was very interested in athletics, and I played basketball the whole time I was in school, and had a lot of fun. And we won the the South Shore Championship on Long Island. So we thought we were pretty good, and I guess we were. It was a lot of fun. I learned so much in basketball, which became a big part of my life.
Well, you also learned how to shoot one-handed. Tell us that story, but your coach wasn't ready for you. Tell us that story.
Oh, yeah. When I played basketball in high school, now you're talking about 38, 39, and 40, we shot fouls underhand, and set shots were with two hands. They even frowned on one-hand passing if you could have done it with two hands. And that was the way it was. We accepted that. But then I told you that we were fortunate that Madison Square Garden was not too far away. And I believe the man's name, Hank Lucetti, and I had another fellow on that team named Stofan, and I'm quite sure the team was Stanford. Hmm. Stanford came to Madison Square Garden, and we heard about, the guys on the team, heard about this one-hand shooting. They were the first ones to bring it on. So we went to Madison Square Garden, watched them do it, came back and tried to do it on our own team, and the coach would have absolutely none of that. But they were the first one-hand shooters, I believe, in the basketball world.
Well, maybe that coach wouldn't have had it, but you ended up deciding to go to Duke, although your dad, who taught at Columbia, was hoping that you would go to Columbia. Tell us about your decision to go to Duke.
Yeah, I can remember very well, of course, my father was a professor at Columbia. He was a chemistry professor, part of his career. And he took me into New York, and I met Lou Little. I remember the name real well. In fact, I got his autograph. Still have it. He was the coach of the football team. Not that I was a football player, but I remember meeting him. And I just did not want to go to school, not only in New York City, but I just as soon wanted to leave the state. I guess that was because I had some friends who went to Duke and had a big time and liked it very much. So I'd never been to Duke, but I did apply, and I was accepted. And that's where I went to college.
And played basketball for Eddie Cameron, right?
That's right. When I got there in 1940, I believe that was the first year that what is now called the Cameron Indoor Stadium, then it was just Indoor Stadium, was there. And so I was lucky to be one of the first to play there. And he was the varsity coach, And when I went to school as a freshman in 1940, nobody could play varsity sports at any college. You had to have a freshman year. I know it was a good idea, too. But I went there as a freshman and played basketball. And I played a good bit. And then when I got my sophomore year, I think I was on the varsity all right, and I played. I played in some games and everything. But I was no star, no starter, but I was a good team player.
Good team player Marshall Rausch. We'll talk about how great a team player he was with Duke and how he went on to become the world's largest producer of Christmas ornaments in the world from Gastonia, North Carolina, when my conversation with Marshall Rausch continues on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Do stay tuned.
Sleigh bells ring. Are you listening?
This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Today, we're meeting Marshall Rausch, former North Carolina senator, recognized for his work in politics and the community. He broke down religious barriers, racial barriers, and also had a very successful business career, and at one point was the largest producer of Christmas ornaments in the world. So we're going to get to that, oh, I promise, but we left you at Duke University, where you were playing on the basketball team. I think at one time you described yourself as a closer, meaning when the team was 40 points ahead, they put you in the game, right?
Exactly. People ask me what I did, how I played. Well, I played in some games. I can even remember the first basket I ever made on the varsity because the score was well in our favor. It was against Davidson, and then they put me in because I was a closer. There were a couple other closers. That meant when we were 20 points ahead, 20 points behind, a minute to go, the closers got to play.
There you go. Well, not only that. So maybe you didn't get a multi-million dollar contract out of that, but you did get something perhaps more precious and more important. It's where you met the woman who would become your wife. Tell us that story.
Yes. That was a freshman year in 1940. And I'm quite sure it was November. And the freshmen played before the varsity. And the freshman game was on, and I had played. And I just came in and sat down on the bench with my buddy. I can't even remember. It was Cedric Loftus. Sat down next to Cedric. And he pointed up in the stands, and he said, "There's a girl you ought to meet." While he's pointing at her, I sort of point at her, too, and she looks down and smiled. Well, hard to believe, I went home and bragged to my roommate, Murray Brandt. He called her for a date. When the time came to go to the date, I wouldn't let him go, and I went and I filled in on his date. And that's how I met Jeannie Girard. We went together for 3 years in college. We became engaged when I went overseas, World War II, for 3 years. And then as soon as I came home, we got married. We were married for 64 years, five great kids, 10 grandchildren, 7 great-grandchildren, and a half.
That's the problem. You get to this age, they're all great, but you got to distinguish between the grands and the great-grands. 64 years, that's remarkable and wonderful. You talked about your military service. You thought you were going to put one, you know, you had one up on the military. You joined the U.S., you joined the reserves, right?
Right. It was not uncommon, I think. Well, most of the fellas in college joined a reserve because, I don't want to say we were promised, but I think we were, that if we joined the reserve, we would stay in college, be graduated, and then go into service. So somewhere around my sophomore year, just like everyone else, I joined the reserve, and I picked Air Force. Well, something changed because in February of my junior year, that'd be 43, they called the reserve. And I went right from Duke into the Air Force. There I thought I was going to be a pilot. However, in pre-cadets, I flew 14 times. I got sick 14 times, and my instructor even told me, don't worry about getting shot down. You'll kill yourself if you keep flying.
I see. Well, and it turns out you weren't much better on the water, right?
I went into the infantry. They sent put me into the infantry after that, and I had an exceptionally fortunate career because I was in combat for about a year and a half, and thank God I never got scratched.
Yeah. You went over on a ship, I think, and called the George Washington. Tell us about that, because there was quite a revelation when you stepped up on the deck of that ship.
Oh, yeah. We went over in a big convoy, and I was on a troop ship, the George Washington. I don't know how many thousand of us were on there, but there were a lot. And it was a convoy. And I didn't like it down in the hold, and I was seasick. I came up, and I was allowed to walk around. I go to the front, and I see the big guns. But they were made of wood. The guns on that troop ship were made of wood. Huh. And, of course, that gave me great confidence. But as I said, there were a lot of destroyers and everything around, and we made it over.
You made it over. You were part of that convoy that got attacked by a German U-boat, right? That turned out to be quite a story.
Not quite. When I was in England, that convoy took us to England, and after about 30 days, we were sent over to France. I went over to France, call it a convoy, of two ships, the Leopoldville and the Cheshire. And that was Christmas Eve. In fact, there's a book about it. It's got the name Christmas Eve in the book, but that's all I can remember. And I was on the Cheshire. Unfortunately, the Leopoldville was torpedoed. And that was the second largest naval disaster in the war. It was terrible. But those of us on the other ship were fine.
Yeah.
And then we went into France.
So terrible, in fact, that the military really didn't publicize it until long after, because they didn't want to give the Germans a kind of moral victory because of the number of people.
Correct. But I remember one thing. They told us, when we landed, you all must write a letter home. So I realized that what that was for, so that if people had heard about it, those that were alive had already written home.
Well, you did come home. Your wife, talk about coming home and seeing Jeannie there in New York. You met in New York, right, when you returned?
Right. The war... We were all sent to Marseille, anticipating going to Japan. And while we were there, I had VJ Day. And then you were allowed to go home based on the points you had earned in service. Points were on time and combat and so forth. So the war was over, and the boats were coming in at New York, and people knew about it. And when I came in, I had my parents, my grandparents, and Jeannie was there. And I remember I hugged everybody, and somehow Jeannie got last, but got a longer hug. And she said to me, "We're getting married in 10 days. I said, "Wonderful." And we were.
And then the choice whether to go back to school or move on, and you decided that maybe it was time to move on. You thought about going back to Duke, but made a different decision. Tell us about that.
Yeah. I went back to Duke with Jeannie, And she was going to take her master's. She had a bachelor's. And I was only thinking that I had 3 years of eligibility. No, I had 2 years of eligibility in basketball. And that's what all I was going back to school for, you know. I was about 23 years old. I just want to go back and play basketball. But when I got down to Gastonia, North Carolina, actually Bessemer City, that's where Jeannie lived with her mother. Her brothers were very nice. They had not been in service, and they said to me, "Now, you've got a job with us, $60 a week. You can come now or you can finish college and come. You've got a job. We want you to work with us."
It's in the textile business, right?
That's right. They were in the cotton, yarn, spinning, and dyeing business. I thought about it, and then I said, "No, I'm not going back to school. I'm 23. I'll get married, have a family, and all that stuff." And so I did not go back to school. I went to work in one of their mills, and I worked the first shift. I think it was 6 a.m. to 2 p.m. And at 3 p.m., I was in Belmont, North Carolina, at the textile school, so that I learned something about it. And I think it's funny that I was such a good employee and worked so hard, I didn't get a raise till I had a baby. And then instead of a 3 or a 5% raise, I had a 33% raise from $60 to $80. So there were some big advantages working for the family.
There were, and yet you decided to branch out on your own. Tell us about that decision.
Yeah, I just wanted to get on my own. They had built a big business, and it was never going to be mine. And I saw an opportunity in packaging crochet thread. And I bought the dyed yarn or thread from my brothers-in-law, who gave me extended terms that permitted me to really get started in the business, because I only had $3,500, which I got on a mortgage on my house to get going. And it was just lucky from one step to another. We made crochet thread, and we made kite cord, and we even worked out a product with hosiery waste to make a potholder frames, and for kids to make potholders out of what were called jersey loops and loopers.
Oh, yeah.
So the business was going pretty well.
Did you pick that up from having worked with your in the family business, or how much of that the textile business did you know about to bring that forward and run your own business successfully?
Well, it wasn't too complicated. Well, another thing, my brothers-in-law looked after me. When I got ready to branch out, they said, "Well, go try it, but keep your day job."
I see.
So yeah. I got it going, and then I remember having a conversation with a brother-in-law. He said, "What's holding you back? Why are you?" I hadn't left them. I had kept my day job. I was talking to him about possibilities, and he gave me the encouragement. He said, "Well, you go start, go, and if it doesn't work, just show up at the front door and you got a job."
pretty good.
Knowing that.
Well, I was going to say that's a good good cushion. So here you are making kite string and pot holders, and then you get a call from a guy named Bill. Tell us about that.
Oh, yeah. Well, by that time, we had a pretty good little business. I think we had about 40 people. I'm pretty sure we did. And we were selling merchandise all over the United States. And phone rings. And the guy says, "Marshall, this is Bill." I said, "Oh, hey, Bill, how are you?" He says, "Fine, how you doing? How's your family?" I said, "Fine, how's your family?" He says, "Fine." said, you playing any golf? Oh, some, not too well. How about your golf, Bill? And just banter like that. Finally, he says, I hear that you can wind a ball. I said, sure, I do it every day. And he said, well, I have a sample, and I'm going to send you a sample of a ball. And if you can make this, we're going to do some big business. I said, wonderful. He said, okay, I'll get to I said, wait a minute, Bill. Which Bill is this? He says, we never met. My name's Bill Spiegel from Chicago. Well, in those days, everybody knew of Spiegel's catalog. Today, they might not know, but that was a big outfit. And he sent a sample of what looked to me to be artificial fruit. It was a paper mache hollow ball that had been wrapped with a 450 denier red rayon thread. And on top of that, there was a little leaf and a stem. And to me, it was an apple. But it wasn't an apple. It was a Christmas morning. I thought I was making artificial fruit. It was difficult to do. And the same gentleman, Mr. Fowler, who my brothers-in-law insisted come with me when I start my business, and it was a wonderful thing they did for me because he knew the textile industry. He looked at it, and he said, I don't know how to make it now, but someone else made it. I can make it. And he worked on it. Spiegel called me, how are you doing? And I said, don't worry about it. Someone else made it. I can make it. I put myself in a hole.
Right. Well, you got a deadline. You know, December 25th is kind of a hard deadline, but keep going.
Yeah. It was difficult. But one day, Mr. Fowler, who was a plant superintendent, who always went home to lunch. That was not unusual with the textile plants and the mill villages right around it. He went home to lunch, and he came back one day, and he said, after lunch, I took my usual nap, and I thought about how we could make that artificial fruit. I said, well, we've got to do it. I've already told Spiegel I can do it. He said, well, it will cost $700. Well, $700 was a lot of money then. $700 was a lot of money. Yeah. I think to give you an idea, I was making $300 a week.
Yeah.
Now that was a gamble.
Yeah. So you're looking at a month. And what year is this now? Give us an idea.
I believe it was right about 1955. He spent the $700, fixed the machine, and he came in my office and said, hey, it's doing it. It's working. I went out and saw it. And somehow Spiegel called maybe a half hour after that. And I told him, we're running it. We'll send you some. He said, no, if you're running it, I'll come down and look at it. And he did. And after he looked at it, he was excited. This had to be around June or July in the year. And he said, how many of these can you make between now and December 1st? And so we figured it out. And I remember it was 300,000 dozen. Now, we sold kite cord for 54 cents a dozen. And this was practically the same thing as running the kite cord. Instead of the paper cylinder that you run crochet thread or kite cord on, we put a styrofoam ball on there, and then we wrapped it with that 450 denier zero twist rayon.
So basically the same process that you were using just to make a holder for kite string, you're actually using now. You're substituting the holder, that little cone for the ornament for that, same
That's
process.
Correct.
And you've already got that thing. I want to talk to you more about this. I'm going to take a break right here. And then we're going to come back and talk more about making Christmas ornaments and much, much more with Marshall Rausch, former North Carolina senator who made a name for himself in North Carolina selling Christmas ornaments. We'll continue our conversation in a moment. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow, talking today with Marshall Rausch, former North Carolina senator who made him a name for himself selling Christmas ornaments in North Carolina and became Marshall Rausch. Were you then the largest manufacturer of Christmas ornaments in the world?
We were. When we were in our heyday, I'd say in 1985 to 95, we were the largest producer of Christmas ornaments in the world. And that was a tremendous advantage because the really big companies like Walmart and Target couldn't get the quantity they needed from anybody but us.
Wow. So did anybody make anything of the fact that here you are, a Jew in the South who's selling, who's the largest manufacturer of Christmas ornaments in the world?
Oh, I've had my buddies tease me about that and still do. It took me a few years to get the right answer, but the answer I give, no, I belong in the Christmas ornament business. One of our fellas started it.
There you go. That is the right answer. Was this then the foundation? I shouldn't say the foundation, but did this become the staple of your business, or were you also making, was this making the most money for you, or were there other things as well?
Well, once we had, by the way, we patented that item, and it was just about the time that the aluminum Christmas tree came out. And the aluminum Christmas tree with a shiny glass ornament looks good, but an aluminum Christmas tree with a satin Christmas ornament looked great. So we were at the right place at the right time. And now we had the satin, and now we had we decided to go into glass because we had so many accounts. And tremendous,
Well, you had a very successful business down there, and then you got involved in politics. Tell us about your decision to run for city council in Gastonia.
I decided to run for city council. As I look back, wow, I was 29 years old. I was from New York. I'd only lived in Gaston County for about 4 years, and I decided to run for city council. Amazingly, I was elected. I think it was because of the family. My wife's family was so well-known and so well-liked. And I did run for city council, got elected. But then I did not run for a second term because that's just about the time that my company was starting to take off. And I didn't want anything to detract from the success of that business. So I got off the city council, but some years later I ran and served another two terms.
You also became the chairman of the Human Relations Committee, and that was responsible for integrating businesses down there. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that was something that is still dear to my heart. Gastonia was just like every other small southern city. You had two water fountains, you know, I think it said colored and white, and you had separate bathrooms and couldn't even eat in the same restaurants, let alone stay in the same motel. Schools were not integrated. And I was asked to be chairman of the I called it the Human Relations Committee that was going to attempt to integrate Gastonia. Well, it was a great committee. We had great fellows on the committee, and we were able to accomplish the integration of Gastonia without incident. We had cooperation from everybody. We slowly.
Forgive me for interrupting, but why do you think that is?
Well, I said we had a great committee, and we would go and, for instance, we went and spoke to a motel owner who had a motel and a restaurant. It was a Holiday Inn in Gastonia. It was the big thing at that time. And Jim Atkins, who was editor of the Gazette, that's a newspaper in Gastonia, and was on our committee, Jim and I went to see, can't remember the gentleman's name, who ran the Holiday Inn. And we said we'd like to bring a black guy, T.J. Jeffers, I believe, Jeffers, who was a high school principal on our committee, a wonderful black guy, wonderful guy. We went to dinner at the Holiday Inn. Smooth. Nothing happened. Sort of put the word out, and that's what started the integration of the restaurants. That's the way we did the whole thing, with a lot of preparation before we attempted to do something that would be visible. On the other hand, there were folks who were against it. I had friends who told me how wrong it was, and they would talk to me about it. That was fine. There was no open protests. And Gastonia is a special city anyway. They had a municipal golf course. And believe it or not, other towns had municipal golf courses. And they were segregated. They wouldn't let black people play. It sounds so absurd. But Gastonia had that opportunity. And we used that as a stepping stone.
They,
as I said,
they integrated.
Wonderful guys.
Yeah, so they integrated. What about you? As you were Jewish, did you encounter much discrimination because of that?
Being Jewish, one or two stupid incidents. Never bothered me.
And apparently didn't bother you for your effort to run for the Senate, in the North Carolina Senate in 1967, right?
That's correct. That's correct. I must tell you, it was nothing effective, but some things were very funny. The first time I ran, and by the way, I did not accept contributions when I ran. The last time I ran, there were contributions, but that was a completely different kind of election. So you could say that 11 times I ran for the Senate, I never accepted a contribution. But there was a billboard up the first time I ran. I put it up. I wanted people to know my name and know I was running. And it was in Cherville. And I went to Cherville to shake hands, and right there with a big sign with my name on it, somebody had written in big black paint, Jew, J-E-W. Well, I didn't like it. But I really had a great answer. The newspaper saw it, called me and said, what do you think about someone writing Jew on your billboard? And I said, by the way he wrote, he's lucky I wasn't Episcopalian. He couldn't have spelled it.
Take it too long. And you won.
Yeah, I won.
Yeah.
I won.
Tell us about that, because you've had some accomplishments as a senator. What are in your mind, some of your greatest accomplishments?
I don't remember the year. I'll take a guess at it and say it was about 1984. Mm. The income tax was 7% for everybody. And I headed a study committee, got a bill written and passed that said that anybody who lived at the poverty level or below, that at that time a family of four with an income of $14,000 was poverty level. Anybody who lived below the poverty level paid no income taxes. As far as I know, that's still a law, but it might have been changed. But also it was important to me not to just spend money. In you're going to spend money, you have to know where the money's going to come from. And so I raised the income tax. I didn't raise it. My idea was to raise it, and then the General Assembly agreed to raise the income tax from 7% to 7.25%, and that was the money that was used to eliminate anybody living at or below the poverty level from paying income taxes. I thought that was a good one.
Yeah, and I should say you served for 24 years and you were in a position to be influential because by then you were the chair of the Senate Finance Committee, which is a pretty important position. So you'd risen in stature even within the Assembly in order to be able to do that. How do you think things have changed? I mean, that was a time in which people understood that you pay taxes and that people who have more are benefiting more by the system, and therefore they pay more in order to fund public services. That was the theory, and it seemed to be a pretty sensible one, not the theory that dominates our legislative thinking today. How do you feel about things today?
Well, you're talking about the difference between Democrats and Republicans.
Hmm.
It's just that simple. The trickle-down does not work. And, you know, that's a whole philosophy. And I was also, I was liberal socially, and I worked hard for education. We had the teacher pay right in the middle. Maybe we were the 20th or 25th state in teacher pay.
Mm-hmm.
Not the last, the way it is now. But that's a whole other book.
Well, let's talk more about you and your businesses, because you also got legislation passed that kept private clubs from getting liquor licenses if they discriminated based on religion, right?
Well said. Absolutely. Absolutely. Some 15 years ago, the only club, private country club that I knew of in the state of North Carolina that had Jewish members was Gastonia. And I think that's because my wife's parents were so involved, not only in the community, but they were textile leaders. And so they, with other textile leaders, started the country club in Gastonia. And so always had Jewish members. However, I know of no other country club that did. And I just waited for the right moment. The right moment came when they rewrote all the laws on liquor, wine, and beer. And I just slipped a simple little amendment in that legislation. And it said, as you pointed out, no private club can receive a license to sell any of these beverages if they discriminate in their membership based on religion. Simple, but it did the job.
Well, it's interesting because you're talking about, when you think about the debate about HB2, outgoing Governor Pat McCrory argued, and as did the GOP legislative leaders, that they had no business regulating private businesses when it came to discrimination. But as you point out, there's a long history in doing just that. In fact, the whole civil rights movement is mm-hmm. based on preventing discrimination among private businesses in order to end segregation. And so it's precisely that you had done many, many years ago, and the legislature, that another bill. So it certainly was not unprecedented to pass an ordinance the way Charlotte did. Talk about your wife, Jeannie. She's so important to you. You mentioned her earlier on. She passed away in 2010. And I wonder about her and what you think about her influence on you, your life, and your work.
Tremendous influence. Just today, people might not look at the marriage that, today women work. And that's wonderful that they were able to. But Jeannie and I had a partnership, and she took care of the home and the children. We're fortunate that she was able to do that. And I must mention that when I started out in the very beginning, she used to come in and do the books. But basically, Jeannie took care of the home, and I was out making a living. I'm sure she loved being with the kids. I'm sure sometimes she'd rather take a break, but she was great for me, for the kids, the family, and I was happy working. I'll tell you the kind of family she built. Still, every Sunday night, I take all the family out to dinner. We're together. That's part of her doing. And the kids learn so much from her. I learned so much from her. I was able to help her in something she really enjoyed, the arts, through the, Raleigh. She was able to serve on the North Carolina Museum of Art and History. And she really enjoyed that, traveled around the country doing it. We had a great marriage, very fortunate, and the kids are fortunate.
You're 93 years old now. As you look back, do you have any regrets? And the other side of that is what are some of the big lessons that you take forward with you?
I'm sure I have regrets. I made so many mistakes, but I'm so blessed. I have this wonderful family. I'm able to go, do, be where I want. And is a little, well, sometimes, well, not sometimes. Anytime I get a chance to speak to people, I always end it this way. I say, remember that every morning you wake up is a blessing. It's up to you to make the day a blessing for someone else. That's what I try.
I'm going to leave it right there because nobody can say it any better than Marshall Rausch. Marshall, thank you so much for joining us.
I thank you. You're a pleasure to talk with. You make it easy.
Well, Marshall Rausch, it is a pleasure to talk with you, and I want to tell everybody that you're a former North Carolina senator, a Gastonia City Council member, and an owner of a business, and much, much more, and you can find out all about our show at our website, stateofthings.org, a program produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Charlie Shelton Orman, Katie Barron, and Laura Pelliser. Robin Copley is the technical director, Brent Wolf, WNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stacio.